Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. I hope you've been able to listen to the two previous podcasts that we have delivered to you this week. The first, with Atul Kohli, looked at American imperialism and compared it to British colonialism. Then James Kurth talked about the American way of empire, how America won a world but lost her way. And now we conclude this series on America's changing role in the world with David Ignatius. He writes a twice-a-week foreign affairs column for the Washington Post. Everyone in Washington reads his column. Ignatius has written 11 spy novels, including his latest, The Paladin. We talk about what's going on in the world today, and we interweave it with the fictional accounts that often ring so true. So, to wrap things up, for us on our Foreign Affairs Week, David Ignatius, here on America Trends. With me on America Trends is David Ignatius, and he writes a twice-a-week foreign affairs column for the Washington Post, and he is prolific also as a writer of spy novels, the latest being The Paladin. And I've got to ask you how the two converge, your life working for the Washington Post, and developing all this material, helping us to understand foreign relations, something that I don't think most of us in America really pay as much attention to as we should, and then writing these spy novels. How does it all come together?
Well, I'm grazing the same terrain, if you will. I'm doing my work as a columnist, writing about the CIA, writing about the world. I'll find issues that really interest me. I'll give you an example from a few books earlier. I traveled in 2006 to Iran and spent a couple of weeks reporting there. This was just as the Iranian nuclear program was becoming a crucial issue for the United States. And I thought, what a fascinating place. What a setting for a novel. And so I came back and drew on the reporting, the sense of place, the travel I made in Iran to write a novel called, it was called The Increment, which was about an attempt to get inside their nuclear program. So that's happened to me often in my work. I'll see something as a journalist that interests me. There's a chance in fiction to take it into another deeper template, if you will, and explore issues. If you're writing a 750-word column, you just don't have much depth to take a big subject like this, whereas in a novel, you can unpack all of it.
The Paladin. Tell us a little bit about it and some of the issues that it raises about the CIA today, journalism. Tell us what it does unpack as it relates to the reality of our times.
The Paladin is the story of a CIA case officer named Michael Dunn, who is assigned to take on an operation to penetrate a quasi-journalistic organization in Europe, run by an American who sees himself as a sort of bandit in the information space, publishing things. The CIA is interested in his operation because, in addition to putting out fake news, if you will, he's creating fake events with his computer technology, imagery that never existed, voices that never actually spoke the words using a technology that's known as deep fakes. So he takes this mission and he is then exposed. That operation penetrating an American journalist's activities is judged to be illegal. He is indicted, convicted. He spends a year in prison. His whole life is essentially shattered. He loses his wife and family. And the book is his effort to understand who set him up, why he was assigned to do this, what this operation really is about, and then to seek revenge against the people who did it.
Now, when we look at all of those who are questioning the validity of intelligence today within our government at the highest levels, I mean, how is it that a CIA agent today working on the ground isn't wondering whether they are going to at some point be in this situation because they have fallen out of favor with the administration? I mean, this feels so real to me.
I think they do wonder that, Larry. I think this is one of the biggest problems as we politicize intelligence. These people, the men and women risking their lives out in the world, feel exposed and vulnerable. They're either asked to do things that are inappropriate and could be left holding the bag, or the information that they gather that matters isn't acted upon. It's suppressed. So I think this is a very difficult time for CIA officers, FBI officers. I think that our country needs a strong intelligence service, to one that operates within the law, one that doesn't torture people, one that doesn't do the things that we have learned are just disastrous. But we need a good intelligence service. It's a dangerous world, and I think it's pretty demoralizing for the people who serve there to be in this kind of environment where they feel like there's always somebody looking over their shoulder, and they don't have backup that they need if they get in trouble.
I think a lot of us are wondering in this period of the coronavirus whether in fact we're really taking our eye off the ball as it relates to foreign affairs, the area in which you are so expert. And I'm wondering what you think about that at this moment. I know the Iranian issue that you raised earlier, we've kind of let that go to the back burner, even though we had a real incident with them just before all of this. Russia, China, of course, were engaged on some levels, and I will get you into that as we move along. But how dangerous is it for us really to seem so adrift at this moment?
Well, I think there's a larger question of American leadership in the world and whether we're playing our hand actively and strictly on the side of intelligence. Our systems of collecting information are largely technical. They're our ability to intercept conversations, to penetrate computers, to see virtually anything from overhead, and all those collection systems continue, and so we shouldn't worry about that. They're machines; they don't get sick. I think another fact about right now is that the whole world really is preoccupied with this pandemic. I spent a day this week talking to people across Europe, from Paris, Berlin, Warsaw, Bucharest, Belgrade, talking to people in each of those cities. And the only big topic of any political concern there, and it'd be true in Moscow too, is people staying healthy. So it's an unusual period. There is, between the U.S. and China, a kind of propaganda battle going on over the origins of COVID-19. I'm one of the people who think that we really need to demand that China have a real investigation, meaning one that includes Western scientists, to figure out how this pandemic began. I think some of the charges that have been made go too far. There's no evidence that this was a deliberate, man-made attempt by China to infect people, but we do need to know whether there might have been a laboratory accident, whether safety procedures are inadequate. The world needs to know, for historical reasons, if nothing else, how this catastrophe that is, you know, going to take us years to recover from, how we need to know how it began.
Now, speaking of China, you recently wrote a piece based on a new book indicating that perhaps we, thinking we have military primacy over China, need to think again. And yet you also wrote a column just a little ways back talking about the fact that perhaps China, we're overestimating their technical capabilities and their 5G and so forth. What is our relationship with China? Are they a trading partner, a competitor, an adversary, an enemy? Who are they in relation to the United States today?
Well, I'd say, Larry, probably all of the above. They are a trading partner, and I hope we'll remain that. They are a competitor, and that competition is deepening. You don't want to say yet that they're an adversary, because although we compete, we're not directly confronting each other. I hope we're not in a cold war with China. The question I was examining with Huawei, which is China's national champion, as they like to say, in telecommunications technology, Huawei is poised to become the dominant provider of what are called 5G telecommunications services around the world. They have got essentially all of that market in China. They're increasingly the dominant player in Europe. And there are concerns in the U.S. and in some European countries that they could just have the kind of monopoly that would cause a security danger. So, looking at some British records generated by their signals intelligence agency, known as GCHQ, they're unclassified, but I was able to get a hold of them, they have looked very carefully at Huawei's technology. And the interesting thing that they found is that it's really quite sloppily constructed on a software basis. The software has hundreds of vulnerabilities, according to one of the reports. The British have asked Huawei to fix these vulnerabilities in the software, and they haven't done it. So all I wanted to say was I think China is a competitor, the likes of which we have never had. I mean, Russia was never going to win any real competition of ideas, anything other than a nuclear exchange with the U.S., but China is a country that's going to be as rich as we are, that's going to be as technologically sophisticated. So we need to look very carefully and assess, you know, are they, what can they do, you know, in an overwhelming way? What's less than that? And I do think Huawei is not quite as good as it was advertised. And it would be a good thing for the U.S. and its allies to think of an alternative technology that wouldn't make people so dependent on a Huawei technology that has got a lot of flaws.
And there's some competition now going on where we are at least in some kind of verbal battle with them about whether we are going to allow them some of the components they need to continue to compete in this 5G space. Should we be watching that over time?
Yes, we've put them on what's known as the entity list, which designates them as an entity that poses national security risks to the United States and so limits the U.S. technology that they can get and that they, I think, still need for their systems. What's exciting and what your listeners should be aware of is that there's a new technology that's emerging that's known as Open Radio Access Networks, or ORAN, which is beyond 5G. It's 3 to 5 years out, but it will be a much cheaper, faster, more secure technology than Huawei's 5G, and it's got the 23 leading telecommunications companies, Verizon, AT&T, go down the list. There isn't a service provider that isn't part of the consortium working on this so-called ORAN technology. So people should get interested in that, and I think companies should be careful about not locking themselves into Chinese Huawei contracts with their version of 5G and preventing themselves from jumping into this new world. Sort of like Huawei may be the Chinese version of Ma Bell or IBM, you know, just before the revolution hits and all of a sudden everything is disrupted. And so people should be careful and know that the future isn't going to be, you know, Huawei dominated, I don't think, if these technologies are allowed to flourish.
Now, you just wrote about military primacy over China and that we may need to think again. What are your thoughts about that?
I think that the China challenge to the United States is to understand that if we keep spending our defense dollars, and we spend nearly $1 trillion a year on defense, we do not need more money. But if we keep spending the money on aircraft carrier, task forces, F-35 fighter jets, these exquisite systems, fantastically expensive. I mean, a Ford class aircraft carriers in the, you know, tens of billions of dollars when you fit it all out. Those legacy weapon systems were designed to project power into the Pacific, into the Persian Gulf, wherever. But they're now vulnerable to Chinese precision anti-ship missiles, other missiles that can take out the tankers that refuel an F-35. So these weapons that we're spending so much money on are probably of fairly limited use in any conflict we might face. And what modernizers like Chris Groves, whose book The Kill Chain I was writing about, argue is we need a cheaper, unmanned, autonomous systems. You can buy 30 unmanned fighter jet equivalents for the cost of one F-35. You can buy 300 unmanned extra large underwater vehicles for the cost of one Virginia class attack submarine. So I think what reformers want is to use the creativity to create a kind of military Internet of Things with lots of smart devices at the perimeter and not these few magnificent platforms. Think of them as the defense version of mainframe computers. We need to be as smart in defense as we've been in Silicon Valley and technology. So that's an argument I think we need to think about in a weird way now when we're all locked down with this virus. It's a good time to think about the basics. What kind of force structure really will deal with the Chinese advances and stop spending so much darn money on aircraft carriers that are vulnerable to missiles and also vulnerable. I mean, as we have just seen, human beings get sick. The Theodore Roosevelt mighty platform can be crippled and Guam can't move.
Yeah,
because
exactly.
It's just a simple thing like disease.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes us different. Our partners are true business advisors, listening, analyzing, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can, anticipating your future goals and drafting plans to make sure you get there. Because at Bloom Shapiro, achieving your success and satisfaction is how we measure ours. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
David Ignatius is with us. Of course, he writes for the Foreign Affairs Desk of the Washington Post, and his columns are always anticipated highly every week. And he's written a new spy novel, The Paladin. He's written 11 of them over time. And, of course, this whole issue of intelligence gathering and, of course, Americans getting caught up in it, even if we're looking for foreign players, Americans do get caught up. And now we're dealing with this issue of the unmasking of General Flynn as we were tracking the ambassador from Russia, Mr. Kislyak. Give us your perspective on this. A lot of Americans, I think, we don't quite understand exactly what's at play here.
Well, the arguments that President Trump makes about this are still somewhat unclear to me as well. I think at the core of this is an issue that I wrote about in the Washington Post in January 2017, the first article that disclosed it, and I just know what that article said. Described how on December 29, 2016, after the election, President Obama ordered the expulsion of 35 Russian spies, presumably, but members of the Russian embassy in Washington and around the country, in retaliation for Russia's having tried to meddle in our 2016 presidential election. It was a kind of action that countries take to exact a cost for this sort of behavior. And on that same day, the 29th of December, Michael Flynn, the incoming national security advisor, called the Russian ambassador, and we now know, talked with him about these expulsions and reassured him that the new administration would handle this and urged him not to do anything to retaliate. And so there was the question of whether that call was appropriate. And I think the difficulty was that Flynn concealed the nature of that call to Vice President Pence, who then made public statements that turned out to be inaccurate. And that's how this whole thing got started. Flynn ended up pleading guilty to a charge that he misled the FBI. He then wanted to withdraw that guilty plea, and the Justice Department just decided that it didn't want to pursue the case, that it felt that the circumstances of what he did didn't rise to the level of an offense that they should charge. So we'll see. The judge who was hearing this case, Judge Emmett Sullivan, has asked for a friend of the court brief from a former prosecutor to assess whether it's wise to grant this Justice Department request, and we'll see how it turns out. But it's a complicated story. Goes back to the beginning of all this. I just want to know one other thing for your listeners. The Senate Intelligence Committee, which is led by a Republican. Republicans control the Senate, spent 3 years investigating whether the intelligence community's allegations that were first made in January 2017 that the Russians had been meddling in our elections were accurate. You know, President Trump often refers to this as the hoax that never happened. Well, a Republican-led committee in the Senate spent 3 years and ended up with a report that said, we believe that the allegations made by our intelligence committee were entirely accurate. Everything they said about what the Russians did was right. So I think, you know, the next time people hear this argument, it's all a hoax, they should just think about this Republican-led committee with some of the top people in the Senate on the Republican side, Marco Rubio, Tom Cotton, just whole string of prominent names voted unanimously to say this was not a hoax, this is real, and we've looked at the evidence and we think it's serious.
Let me go back to the intelligence agencies and their operations and your book. After 9/11, of course, we wanted a lot more crosstalk between security agencies like the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, so that we could ensure that these operations were going undetected and slipping through the cracks and we could avoid that. Now, in the book, The Paladin, you imagine this CIA agent infiltrating an American journalism operation overseas. Could you see the jurisdictions going on now in real life being blurred to the extent that this is possible or potentially going on as we speak?
It's a question, and I don't know the answer to it. The executive order that defines the CIA, the intelligence community's activities, makes very clear that spying on American journalists is against the laws laid out in this executive order. And in my novel, that's the basis on which my hero, Michael Dunn, is indicted and convicted. Has the CIA tried to infiltrate in some way, gather intelligence about WikiLeaks, let's say, the organization run by Julian Assange? I don't know. He's not an American, so the same rules wouldn't apply. But, you know, that's the kind of question I've tried to find out the answer to that, to be honest, Larry, for the last 3-4 years, and I haven't gotten the answer. One of my earlier novels, the director imagined a situation with somebody a little like Edward Snowden. Would our intelligence agencies be allowed to gather intelligence about his activities? I guess under the usual rules of preventing insiders from leaking classified information, that they would. But it's a very interesting, complicated area. The honest answer is it's secret. We don't know who they target.
Is the idea of who is a journalist today and whether events are real, whether they're manufactured, whether in fact they are recreated for social media and can have some tremendous implications instantly as it relates to financial trades and the like. How important is it for journalists like you, who also like to delve into fiction, to really protect the sanctity of what a real curated journalistic piece is, as opposed to a lot of faux journalists who are out there today under the guise of journalism, but they're publishing on their own, and who knows whether it is on behest of a government or on behest of just making a financial killing by getting this clickbait out to people who are so predisposed.
You just described very clearly what the basic theme of this novel, The Paladin, is. This is about a world where you just don't know whether the information coming at you is real and believable or fake and manufactured in a computer, and you need to be careful with every piece of information that you consume, whether you're an intelligence agency. How does our CIA verify that an intercept that it's got of a conversation, that really happened? Because you could create false images, false voices, you could mislead your adversary so easily. How does a person trading in financial markets know that information, to take a couple of examples from my novel, a report of a big oil spill from a tanker that's going to have a devastating effect on the stock price of an oil company. How do you know that's real? You see video footage, but it would be easy to create that video footage. I explain the ways you do that in my book. Or let's say there's a particularly high-flying company led by a charismatic CEO. Let's say there's a report that man has secretly suffered a terrible fatal illness and will be dead in a month. You know, news that would send that stock plunging if it got up. So that too could be manufactured. You could create fake information that would make people in financial markets believe that there was something happening that wasn't. So I've come to think that the value of what I try to do as a journalist, what people in my business do, which is to sift through all this information and tell readers this is true and here's how I know it's true. The value of that's going to become much more. People will pay more for information that they know is accurate in a world where there's so much information that could be fake, could be intended to mislead you. So So that's my hope, is there'll be a more money to be made telling the truth than creating lies.
I don't know. The Russians, you wrote, manipulated our elections. We helped. I know Facebook is trying to clamp down on, you know, sending out and purveying more of this material. What do you think we should be looking for in the coming period? We're only 6 months out from an election.
So we're a democracy. We want there to be open information, and that means that information that sometimes that's false or certainly that's manipulative is going to be in our information ecosystem. We need to understand that the Russians and other adversaries, the Chinese, the Iranians, view the information space as a domain of war. They view it as part of a continuum of conflict that rises through information all the way up to a shooting war. And in that situation, we just need to be especially careful about anything that comes at us. I know that Facebook, other social media platforms are thinking hard about how they verify the reliability of images, information that's displayed on their platform. And when they see something they know to be false, they take it down. They should. I think that's appropriate. People get angry sometimes. They think the decisions are political. But, you know, this is the balance between having an open society and being completely vulnerable to those who would manipulate us, lie to us, take down our politics, really is a tough balance. And it's going to take smart people. But in the end, the last thing I'd say about this, Larry, is in the end, it comes down to us as consumers. You know, Facebook can take responsibility for trying to have a clean ecosystem, clean platform, but it's your responsibility as a consumer of information to make judgments about what's true and what isn't, not to fall for stuff that just is out there trying to enrage you, manipulate you, use you as a pawn in a game you don't understand. Basically, it's on us.
Is it that much more difficult today to do that when we see our own government playing certain games that seem so propagandistic and so difficult for us to figure out fact from fiction, so we're getting it from all sides? It just feels so difficult.
I think it is difficult. I think this is really the challenge of our time. We have this proliferation of information. It's fantastic, the information that's, you know, at a keystroke for all of us. That comes with an obligation, I think, to be good stewards of information, to exercise good information hygiene, if you will, to know what's contaminated, what might poison the well of information that we draw on. If we let true and false get so mixed up, sometimes I worry most that we're in a situation where we have competing narratives about what's happening in the world. And if you turn on different cable news channels, it's as if you're hearing about two competing realities. I'm not sure a democracy is going to work when you have two versions of the fact. Somehow people are going to have to get past that. And I know in the financial markets, people know that short sellers, you know, fraudsters are always trying to manipulate. People are smart about financial information. They need to be that smart about political information.
In closing, just two more questions. I know that there's some kind of ceremony going on as you and I speak about the Space Force getting ready to launch. What is the Space Force?
Space Force is a newly created force, like under the Department of the Air Force, the way the Marine Corps is under the Department of the Navy. It was created because it was decided, ultimately by the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, too, that the Air Force simply hadn't been as aggressive as it needed to be in thinking about the vulnerability of space-based assets. The Air Force was focused on the kind of, you know, the terrain in which, the airspace in which their jets fly. Of course, that's what they did. And we thought of space as a benign environment. We put overwhelming percentage of the assets we use to command, control, communicate with our forces around the world in space. And we realized about 10 years ago, that is to say the Air Force realized, the government as a whole, that the Chinese in particular were aggressively moving to treat space as a potential domain of conflict. They were developing weapons, lasers that could blind our spy satellites so we couldn't see what, you know, missile launches or other military activities. The Chinese and Russians were developing weapons that were literally kinetic kill vehicles to knock satellites out of the sky. So this kind of snuck up on people, and the Space Force is an attempt to take it much more seriously, to create a dedicated digital force. I've talked with the new chief of staff of the Space Force, General Raymond. He's just first rate, and he's trying to create a force that's really very much 21st century. Their logo looks a little bit like the Star Wars logo on the uniforms that we remember. But you know, he's trying to think, if you're an executive in a really smart, high-tech company involved in space, why couldn't you be commissioned as a colonel or a lieutenant colonel in a reserve of the Space Force? You'd spend, you know, a week and a month working on these projects for the government. There are a lot of people, to be honest, out there in the private sector who'd love the chance to be involved in these activities. So we've got a lot of innovative ideas like that. But you'll hear, I promise you, you and your listeners will hear a whole lot more about the Space Force soon.
Okay. In closing, you care passionately, obviously, about America's role in the world. And two of the colleagues who join you often on a morning cable program, one has written a book saying that America, welcome to the world. Let us introduce you to it because you really don't understand it. And another one of your colleagues at the Washington Post, Eugene Robinson, just wrote that, America has been loved and loathed over the years. But more recently, we've been mocked and pitied over our response to coronavirus. That seems like a pretty important tandem of things to worry about, that we don't understand the rest of the world, and maybe we're indifferent to the rest of the world, and at what peril. And are we, in fact, looking at an America that can't look at itself as set apart and very special and exceptional, and that now we're showing our vulnerabilities?
Well, I think our vulnerabilities are clear. They're clear to people abroad, and I think should be clear to us as Americans. We have a political system that at the national level is broken. We have a Congress that is just so divided and polarized. It just can't pass major legislation, whether it involves health care, immigration, any of the issues that Americans care about. That, you know, when you have a broken political system, that's a problem. It needs to be fixed. The world looks at us and they think, geez, these Americans just have trouble getting their act together. At the same time, we had this breakdown at the national level. I mean, I won't go into President Trump. People have their feelings about him. I have mine. But we obviously, he's part of a dysfunctional system right now. But at the same time, there's some incredibly functional and successful parts of America. Our companies, our technology companies, still are dominant. The Chinese are rushing to catch up, but they're in the game, but they're not where we are. In the financial sector, we have a global financial economy that totally is driven by, looks to the leadership of our Federal Reserve. Our Federal Reserve is a more dominant global player today than it ever has been. The international financial system literally couldn't manage a crisis like this without wise leadership from the Fed. We have a Fed chairman, Jay Powell, who, you know, wisely ignores all the criticism he gets from the White House and just does his job. So people shouldn't forget, we are disorganized. We do have a political breakdown. We got to fix it. But there are a lot of things, goodness, that are still working right.
All right. Well, that's a good note to leave on. David Ignatius. And again, you can read him in the Washington Post, or you can pick up The Paladin or any of the other spy novels that he's written over the years. David, truly an honor to have you with us today on America Trends.
Great, great conversation. Thanks for giving me a chance to think about these issues with you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. At Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, discovering what makes you different is what makes Bloom different.